You're listening to The Point. Racial segregation is still a reality across American neighborhoods, and it has social, economic, and political ramifications. Historians, sociologists, and even the U.S. court system have maintained no one knows what causes segregation to persist. But Richard Rothstein's new book, The Color of Law, lays out the argument that African Americans were unconstitutionally denied the means and right to integrate middle-class neighborhoods. And this denial wasn't just ignored by state and federal government, it was promoted. Richard Rothstein, welcome to the program. Good to see you.
Thank you very much.
So you're a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute, which is a nonprofit organization created to broaden the discussion about economic policy to include the interests of low and middle income workers. So when and why did you become interested in exploring the causes of persistent racial segregation in the U.S.?
Well, actually, I used to specialize mostly in education policy, and I spent a lot of time looking at the racial achievement gap in schools. The racial achievement gap is caused primarily by the fact that disadvantaged children, African-American children, for example, come to school with economic and social problems that impede their learning. So they live in neighborhoods that where they're more likely to have asthma because of the pollutants. And if they have asthma, they're up at night wheezing. They don't, they're drowsy when they come to school. Maybe they're absent from school. They live in they have families with who are jobless and suffer frequent unemployment, and they come to school under stress, which interferes with their learning. Well, it's one thing if children like that are in a school where not every child has those kinds of problems. They can get special attention and perhaps do better than they otherwise would. But when you have schools which are filled with children like that, where every child has some kind of economic or social problem that impedes his or her learning, it becomes impossible for the school to accomplish what it could accomplish in a school where children could focus on their learning. So I began to wonder why this was, and it's obvious. The reason that we have segregated schools today is because they're located in segregated neighborhoods. And then the Supreme Court said that we can't do anything about this because the neighborhoods were segregated de facto, was the term they used, simply because of private prejudice or people's choices of where to live, or real estate agents who may have steered them to neighborhoods of the same race. And there was nothing we could do about that because these were all millions of informal, individual decisions, and the Constitution doesn't permit the government to redress individual, personal, non-governmental actions. Only if segregation was what they called de jure, the result of government law or policy, is there a remedy. And so I began to look into why these neighborhoods were segregated, and the result was that I found a hidden history. Not hidden, I'm sorry, a forgotten history. Mm. It was not hidden at all. It was well known, a forgotten history of how the federal, state, and local governments explicitly designed racial segregation. I'm not talking about in the South, in the North, in the Midwest, in the West, creating the segregated metropolitan landscapes that we're familiar with today. And if people were aware of that history, it was once well known, it wasn't a secret, but if people became aware again of that history, they would understand that the racial segregation of metropolitan areas was created unconstitutionally. And created unconstitutionally, there's an obligation to remedy it.
So remind us of the protections that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment should be affording all Americans, regardless of race.
Well, the 14th Amendment prohibits the government from discriminating, prohibits state governments from discriminating, from treating people unfairly because of their race. The 5th Amendment prohibits the federal government from doing the same thing. The 13th Amendment prohibits slavery. It banned slavery. But it also empowered Congress to enforce that law by defining what the characteristics of slavery were, what the residues of slavery were. And Congress in 1866 defined one of the characteristics of the residues of slavery, what it called the badges and incidents of slavery, is the lack of freedom to purchase property and to rent property on the same basis as whites, second-class citizenship, in effect. Mm-hmm. So these amendments and the laws that enforce them have been on the books for 150 years, that would have permitted African Americans to integrate into metropolitan areas throughout the country, but they were not enforced. In fact, more than not enforced, the federal, state, and local governments blatantly violated them by prohibiting African Americans from living in white neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. Where do we see the evidence of the state-sponsored segregation starting?
Well, the first public housing that we've had in this country for civilians was designed for middle-class, working-class whites, not for African-Americans. It came about in the Depression when families were without housing. And the federal government, the Public Works Administration, one of the first New Deal agencies, began to build housing for primarily white students across the country. They built some housing for African-Americans as well, but it was always segregated. And it was built as segregated public housing in neighborhoods that were integrated before in many cases. Langston Hughes, the great African-American poet and novelist, writes about how he grew up in an integrated neighborhood in Cleveland, and his best friend was Polish. He dated a Jewish girl. The Public Works Administration came into that neighborhood, demolished it on the grounds that it was slum housing, and built segregated public housing, one project for African-Americans, a separate project for whites, creating segregation where it had never before been known. So this went on across the country. During World War II, workers flocked to defense plants in areas where there may not have been African Americans living before. Both black and white workers flocked to these defense plants. The federal government built housing for defense workers because the populations of these defense centers exploded as this large migration of workers came to get jobs. Defense was the only place where jobs were available at that time. The federal government had to build housing if it wanted the assembly lines to keep on going, and it built segregated public housing for workers in areas where perhaps there would never have been African Americans before. There was no history of segregation. So public housing began in this way, and then the federal government had another program, which was as equally as powerful. And this was the Federal Housing Administration, which in the 1940s and 50s began to subsidize mass production builders of large subdivisions in suburbs around the country on condition that those builders sell no homes to African Americans. So, for example, perhaps the best known of those developments is Levittown, 17,000 homes just east of New York City. William Levitt and his family could never have assembled the capital to build 17,000 homes on their own, for which they had no buyers yet. They were able to build those homes only with a federal government guarantee of their bank loans, and the federal government required that that guarantee be conditioned on them. They're selling no homes to African Americans, and they're putting a clause in the deed of every home prohibiting resales to African Americans.
How did the Federal Housing Administration justify discriminatory practices like that?
Well, first of all, let me say it was very explicit. This was not an implicit policy. It's not that they didn't claim to be discriminating and African Americans just came to the builders and weren't allowed to buy. This was written in their manuals. And they justified it by saying that property values would decline if we had integrated neighborhoods. There was absolutely no evidence for that whatsoever. In fact, property values, what the research showed at the time, was property values increased when African Americans moved into neighborhoods where whites were living, because African Americans have so many fewer housing choices, they were willing to pay more for the same housing in places where they were permitted to buy than whites were. But this rationale of the Federal Housing Administration continued all the way into the 1950s and 60s.
Mm. Tell us what redlining is.
Well, redlining began again under the New Deal. One of the very first New Deal agencies was the Homeowners Loan Corporation. The Homeowners Loan Corporation was designed to provide new mortgages for families who were being evicted from homes because they couldn't afford their mortgage payments. At the time, there were no amortized mortgages. You got a mortgage for a term of perhaps 5 years, and at the end of that 5 years, you had to pay it off in full or get a new loan. The Homeowners Loan Corporation drew maps of every metropolitan area in the country, instructing appraisers of where the risk of lending would be too high for the Homeowners Loan Corporation to reissue mortgages. the maps were colored red in areas where African Americans lived or in areas where African Americans lived nearby to tell appraisers that they should not value those homes as being worthy of a federal guarantee. And so that's where the term redlining comes from. It was a federal program. Of course, the real estate industry then adopted it. But without those federal maps, we would never have had redlining.
You have an image in the book. You're mentioning Levittown, Pennsylvania, and this is from 1954. It shows a large crowd of white people dressed in white assembling before proceeding to harass the first African-American family moving into that white development. Tell us more about the Levittown development and what happened to the African-American families who did try to move in.
Well, the development you're talking about is Levittown, Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Not the Levittown, New York, I was talking about a few minutes ago. But it was very commonplace throughout the country that when African Americans moved into a home, if they were fortunate enough to be able to buy a home, that a white seller who was willing to violate the federal policy because, as I said, they could get more money from an African American than they could from a white buyer. When African Americans were able to buy homes in predominantly white neighborhoods, typically they were driven out by violence. Homes were firebombed. Riots occurred. In Levittown, Pennsylvania, the one you're talking about, white community rented a house next door to that, the house that the African American family bought, and created a Ku Klux Klan headquarters in that house, all under police protection. One police officer who tried to interfere with a white mob was removed from duty because he was trying to protect the African-American family. And so across the country, police enabling of violence against African-American movers, and these were all middle-class families, by the way, because they were buying homes in middle-class neighborhoods. Police protection of this violence went on, and this was also a violation of the 14th Amendment. This was state action. The police are the agents of the state, and this was unconstitutional. It would be one thing if you had a rogue police officer.
But this wasn't a rogue police officer. This was like departments, right?
That's right. This was police policy.
So how were African Americans responding to this blatant racial discrimination? I mean, were there legal challenges?
Well, that's very interesting. There were some legal challenges. The African American legal establishment, the NAACP at the time, it later became the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, was so focused on school segregation in this period that they had very few resources to devote to other issues. So there were some challenges. One case eventually got to the Supreme Court in 1948. The Supreme Court did rule that it was a violation of the Constitution for state courts to evict families who had bought homes in white neighborhoods in violation of these deeds that were put into the homes. But that was the only major case that the federal government, the Supreme Court took up under this under the housing area. As I say, they were mostly concerned with school segregation and had little time or resources to devote to housing. The reality is, unfortunately, if we had challenged housing segregation, we probably would have done more to desegregate schools than by challenging school segregation directly.
What was the impetus for the passage of the Fair Housing Act of 1968, and did it begin to bring any kind of equity to housing in the United States?
Well, the Fair Housing Act was the culmination of the Civil Rights Acts of the 1960s. It was adopted after having failed to go through Congress several times before, but it was adopted in 1968 in the wake of the assassination of Martin Luther King, and the country, and led by Lyndon Johnson, felt that something had to be done about the housing segregation. So the Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968, which prohibited private discrimination in housing. It prohibited it in an ongoing, forward-looking basis. It did nothing to undo the segregation that had been created by the federal, state, and local governments in the decades before that. And housing segregation is a little bit different from the other kinds of segregation that were abolished by the Civil Rights Acts of the 1960s. If we abolish segregation in buses, the next day somebody can sit anywhere they want on a bus. Mm-hmm. If we abolish segregation in a restaurant, the next day you can go in and get served at restaurants. But if you abolish segregation in housing, the next day all the families who have been denied housing for generations in middle-class neighborhoods can't pick up and move to middle-class neighborhoods.
Right.
So it's a much more difficult thing to undo. And simply prohibiting future discrimination, as the Fair Housing Act did, an important reform, I'm not minimizing it, but it did nothing to reverse the segregation that had been created by generations of federal policy before that.
Is there evidence that housing segregation has resulted, has put African Americans at a disadvantage socially and economically? I would think, yeah, right?
Yes, absolutely. Let me give you the example I was talking about before. I was talking about Levittown. In 1947, that development was built east of New York City on Long Island, Nassau County. Levitt sold those homes to white families only, where African Americans were prohibited from moving, for about $7,000 or $8,000 apiece. In today's dollars, that's about $100,000.
Yeah.
So, and $100,000 was at that time, in today's currency, about twice national median income. African Americans and whites could both have afforded to buy homes at twice national median income, especially with Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administration guarantees. So these were reasonably affordable. Had the federal government permitted integration in Levittown, there would have been many African-American families who bought homes there. Today, those homes in Levittown sell for $300,000, $400,000, which is about seven times national median income. Those houses are no longer affordable to working-class, lower-middle-class families. So simply saying to African-Americans in the Fair Housing Act, in effect, okay, you can now go buy a home in Levittown, is kind of an empty promise, because the homes that were affordable to their families, to their parents or grandparents, a generation or two generations ago, are no longer affordable to them today. So much more aggressive action needs to be taken to undo the segregation that was created by the federal government than simply passing a Fair Housing Act.
How do other races and minority groups fare when we look at segregation? You know, are Hispanics and East Asians just as likely as African Americans to live in segregated neighborhoods?
Well, I think it's important to make a distinction between low-income neighborhoods and segregated neighborhoods. There's been some government-endorsed discrimination against Hispanics and Asians, particularly in California. But generally, throughout the 20th century, the target of federal segregation policy was African Americans. Low-wage immigrants, whether they're Poles or Italians or Jews or the Irish, who come to this country for the first time, as well as Hispanics, typically live in neighborhoods that are low income. They have low wage jobs. They need to live in places where their language is spoken, where they can gradually adjust to the culture of a new country. So it's not unusual for low income families to live in neighborhoods where their ethnic group is concentrated. But that's a very different situation from families who are living in those neighborhoods because of federal, state, mm-hmm. and local policy that prohibited them from living anywhere else. African Americans aren't living in concentrated areas of poverty because they are choosing to live in neighborhoods where their language is spoken mm-hmm. or where their culture is familiar. They're living there because they were prohibited from living anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And that's a big difference between them and other minority groups.
What are the negative consequences for racial segregation for whites?
Well, there are very serious negative consequences. Many of our political divisions rest on racial segregation. That's one. Research shows that racial segregation contributes to bad decision making. When you get a group of, there have been experiments showing that when you get a group of people together who are all similar in their backgrounds, they tend not to challenge assumptions that are being made. When you get a diverse group, participants are much more creative because they have to think through their own assumptions. Of course, the social problems that we have in this country, which disrupt our politics and disrupt our social life, are largely attributable to segregation. We would not have the kinds of police youth confrontations that we've seen in this country in the last few years if it weren't for segregated neighborhoods where police are occupying forces and where Young men are hopeless without jobs, without access to transportation, and that affects our politics generally. So segregation has ripple effects throughout the country in its political as well as its economic life.
There's this perception that crime rates in black neighborhoods are high. There's this gang culture and drug use and sales are rampant. How do we break that cycle and at the same time encourage the integration of whites into those neighborhoods?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is encourage the and permit and create the conditions for the integration of African Americans into middle class neighborhoods. Integration is not going to primarily be accomplished by whites in the suburbs moving into urban areas, although that's happening to a small extent. Integration is going to happen if African Americans are permitted to move into all white suburbs. And many of these suburbs, for example, have zoning laws which prohibit the construction of townhouses or single-family homes and small lot sizes. Those zoning laws are unconstitutional, and in light of the history that I've described, many of them were adopted with an explicit racial purpose. Those zoning ordinances need to be prohibited so that we can permit African Americans to move into those communities and permit developers to build homes that are affordable to working class and middle class African Americans.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that it's still today African American families are not moving into white middle class neighborhoods because of this history that's still not accessible to them?
Well, they in large part it's because of the unaffordability mm-hmm. of middle class neighborhoods to working class and lower middle class African Americans. That's one reason. Another reason is they continue to face hostility when they move into white neighborhoods. Police follow mm-hmm. them home thinking that they're outsiders. Young men are followed around in stores thinking mm-hmm. that they're criminals. Teachers aren't familiar with them and look down on them and have low expectations. So there are all these problems that need to be overcome, but we can't begin to overcome them unless we understand how they arose. And this history is essential to beginning to grapple with the problem of how we desegregate the country.
Some have called for reparations for African Americans. What are your views on that?
Well, I prefer the term remedies to reparations. The kinds of things that are needed to remedy the segregation that was unconstitutionally created by government go far beyond monetary payments, which is what most people think of as reparations. The kind of repeal of exclusionary zoning ordinances that I mentioned before is a remedy. It's not a monetary payment to African Americans. So remedies are a much broader term. If you prefer to think of reparations more broadly as including policies mm-hmm. that promote integration as well as monetary payments, I don't have any objection to that. But I think the term remedies suggests a much broader approach to this problem mm-hmm. than reparations.
And I think you said something in the beginning that this wasn't a hidden history, but more of a forgotten history. So as people are seeing this information and seeing how unfair this was, what's been the response? What are your expectations as people learn this history? What will happen?
Well, I'm not the only one who's talking about this history. Many books were written years ago about it, and some of them are still assigned in college courses and perhaps will be more assigned as a result of renewed attention to it. There are other authors who are writing about this. Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Atlantic has been writing about it. A writer for the New York Times Magazine, Nicole Hannah-Jones, has been writing about it. So I'm hoping that as more people remember this history and relearn the history, that we'll begin to be able to grapple with ways to undo the unconstitutional actions of the federal government. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I write about in my book is the fact that high school textbooks misstate this history. Worse, they lie about this history. They adopt the myth of de facto segregation. They make no mention whatsoever of the segregation policies of the public housing authorities, of the Federal Housing Administration. If we don't reform our high school curricula, the next generation will be as incapable of dealing with this problem as our generation mm-hmm. has been. So I think one of the first things we need to do is look at high school curricula and make sure they teach this history so that the next generation learns it.
We were both around in the 1960s and remember those turbulent times. And sometimes I think, really? So many years later, and we really still have so much prejudice in this country. So do you think we can achieve racial desegregation in our country? And you sort of touched on this, but if so, what are some of the first steps we as a nation and as citizens should be taking?
Well, I think the first steps is to have a conversation about the history. We can't move forward so long as we deceive ourselves into thinking this all happened because of private action. It is, of course, a chicken and egg situation. Private attitudes affect government policy, and government policies affect private attitudes. But without the government policies that I've been describing to you, the private attitudes would not have been effective in creating a segregated America. Sure, there would have been prejudice. Sure, there would have been discrimination in the private sphere. But this was all structured and reinforced by federal policy. For example, white flight. Now, white flight in neighborhoods where African Americans move in is frequently cited as a private action, something that the government has no control over. But white flight exists only because there are so many all-white neighborhoods from which African Americans have been excluded. And if every neighborhood, every community, every suburb was integrated, there would be no place to flee to when African Americans moved into a neighborhood. So these things are inextricably bound together. I think clearly there will continue to be prejudice. We're not going to eliminate it. But government policy has a powerful role in structuring the way people's actions are implemented. And I think that we need to begin to think of creative ways of implementing policy that will desegregate metropolitan areas.
The book is titled The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Richard Rothstein, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.